This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. It's time once again to discuss this past week's important news with our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Hello.
After nearly two decades of fighting in Afghanistan, America is trying to bring the war to a close, not by defeating the enemy, but by negotiating with it and leaving it in power. Stephen Fleury talked about this earlier on in the week and wrote an article that's posted at thetrumpet.com about it. We're going to hear about it by turning to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
So the United States has been trying to find a way out of this war for a long time. It's been almost two decades that the U.S. forces have been there. I think we're up to about $800 billion that the U.S. has committed to the fight. That's a lot of money. And so we have the U.S. president that's really dedicated to try and pull the United States forces out of there, again, in a really difficult situation. Because with the evacuation of U.S. forces, the country itself looks like it would fall back under Taliban rule, all of it. Right now, the Taliban holds more control of territory than it did before the United States actually went into Afghanistan. And the Taliban, of course, they it's up to 60% now of the country they control. The Taliban, they were the ones that they gave safe shelter to, or safe haven to, Al-Qaeda. And out of that is what caused the September 11th terrorist attacks. Osama bin Laden was hiding up in Afghanistan. And that was largely due to the fact that the Taliban was there, allowing Al-Qaeda to operate out of there. So the latest reports are that the United States right now has just concluded a few days ago, 7 days of talks with the Taliban directly, bypassing the interim Afghani government that does look after about half of the country. And those talks took place in Qatar. There was a special envoy of the United States that was leading those, and apparently they've had a breakthrough whereby the U.S. would agree to withdraw its forces from Afghanistan, and the Taliban has promised to not allow its territory to be used by international terrorist actors. That is a promise.
That's what we get in exchange for pulling out a promise.
Right, and so. Yeah, I mean, everyone is looking at this thinking it's absolutely shocking. It's absolutely, how could the United States do this? I mean, but you've also got to know that the United States has been calling for a retreat of its soldiers out of Afghanistan. And so what do you do? What do you do? Do you decide now that, okay, well, let's get out and hope for the best, or we maintain forces there and still the Taliban gains territory against the mighty United States? I mean, President Obama, he had a troop surge there of 100,000 men. And even when he had 100,000 men there, he was trying to negotiate with the Taliban to show that, hey, we'll stay there. We'll stay there with our men unless you kind of agree to certain stipulations, work with the temporary or Afghani government, the interim government, and quit supporting terrorists in your territories that you control. And they disagreed back then to Mr. Obama. And now you have less troops. And so the President Trump comes in with less of a negotiating position. And what we see here in these negotiations is what happens when you in that situation. The Taliban are virtually... they have more control than they had at the beginning, and they basically are saying to the United States, okay, we'll do what you say if you remove your forces. And so there are no guarantees, it seems, if the U.S. pulls out.
Nearly 20 years, the expenditure of manpower, the lives lost, the expenses of this war. You go back and you look at what the Trumpet was saying at the very beginning when we first sent troops into Afghanistan, and you have to marvel at just how prescient those forecasts based on the prophecies of the Bible really were.
Yeah, you're right. From the very beginning, we've spoken about how the United States was going to go in strong, and they did go in strong for a long time in Afghanistan. But we spoke about how this was not going to end up being a victory for the United States, because God, as we mentioned, based on prophecies found in the book of Leviticus and Deuteronomy, that God had broken the power of the United States, and that this was going to be an example, this war of America's strength spent in vain. And I don't think that you're going to find an arena in the world, anywhere for, as far as U.S. missions go, where more lives, thousands of lives and more money has been spent on a mission that has been a disaster, given the fact that the Taliban is in a better position now than they were when the United States entered the fight. The late trumpet writer, Mr. Ron Fraser, wrote back in 2006, this is already 4 years into the war, he wrote, quote, "The Taliban is back in Afghanistan and it is there to stay. With the arrival of each fighting season, gradually wear down the resistance of the United States-led coalition forces and American public opinion." That was 2006. And here we are, 2019, and they have. They come out and fight every summer. They gain more territory, and as far as this, the Afghan war, it's I forget the approval rating of the U.S. public opinion right now, but it's one of the lowest wars in America's history. Everyone wants the U.S. forces to get out, apart from the Afghanis. They don't want the U.S. forces to get out. The interim prime minister, president, forget what it is, he wrote to President Trump 2 days ago a letter after hearing about these negotiations. And he said, basically, please don't go. We need you. We'll cut you a deal. You can stop sending your aid towards the nation building component. Stop sending the contractors over to help us build back our state. But we need your forces. We need some type of arrangement, or we're going to be overrun by the Taliban completely. That's what the Afghanis are saying, that don't want to be under the Taliban. But the United States right now, I mean, this is an unwinnable war when God is not blessing but cursing your armed forces.
Right, and that's exactly what Stephen Fleury pointed to. These the scriptures that we've pointed our readers and our listeners to so many times over these last two decades as the United States has been waging this war. Leviticus 26, verses 19 through 21, "I'll break the pride of your power." It says, "And your strength shall be spent in vain if you walk contrary to me and will not hearken unto me." I don't think there's any more vivid illustration of the fulfillment of that prophecy, strength spent in vain, than what we've seen in Afghanistan. I suppose you could add what has happened in Iraq over the last, not quite as long, two, 3 years less, but the same story playing out there. But remarkable to see this beginning to wind down, and it looks like America's chapter in that country could very well be coming to a close in just about the most ignoble way you could imagine. I would encourage you to go to thetrumpet.com and look at this article by Stephen Fleury, "America Negotiates Defeat in Afghanistan." It was printed on January 30th. Just a couple of days ago, but it and that radio program, it's based on that radio program that he gave a few days ago about this very important story, and something that we really does vindicate the prophecies of the Bible. Well, we appreciate that, Brent. When America pulled out of its nuclear deal with Iran and reimposed economic sanctions on that terrorist-sponsoring nation, it marked a real break in foreign policy with Europe, which wanted to preserve the deal. Well, now European nations are looking for ways to get around America's new sanctions. For this story, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, so yesterday, Britain, France, and Germany announced a new entity called the Instrument in Support of Trade Exchanges, or INSTEX, I guess you'd pronounce it, something like that. It'll be managed by a German former banker. His name is Per Fischer, and the idea is to help Europe trade with Iran. And now that America is putting sanctions on Iran, it will help them keep trading with them. But this new body is about a whole lot more than Iran. And really, in a lot of ways, it's not even about Iran. I thought the EU Observer had an excellent article on this called Iran, EU and Trump Mark Divorce on the World Stage, where you're seeing this split between the two, and you're seeing this split when it comes to sanctions. You know, there's a whole load of areas where Europe and America do not see eye to eye. There's even more and more talk recently about this natural gas pipeline that Germany and Russia are working on that brings gas directly to Germany. And Europe and America is threatening to put sanctions on German companies that are involved in this gas pipeline. So you're having people in Europe increasingly thinking, we're in an economic war, or at least economic competition with the United States. And America, over the years, they've, and the fact that the dollar is at the foundation of the world's currency, they have a huge advantage in this conflict. At the moment, they can tell a European company that does business with Iran, and you know, that doesn't even really necessarily have anything to do with the United States, they can still say, we're going to put sanctions on you, and that company is going to have to obey, or it's going to find itself cut off from banks and loans, and it will find itself in big trouble. So Europe's looking at this, and you know, they're thinking, well, we need to do something to fight back. And that's what this Instex is all about. It's about Europe taking some of the first initial steps to find a way to do without the United States and to combat this massive economic weapon that Europe has, that America has. This EU Observer article, it quotes from I think one of the commentators on Carnegie Europe, who talked about this has a potential to teach its managers lessons that can be applied to other cases besides Iran in the future. So they've got this situation where these two sides disagree with Iran. As we've heard from Brent, even over the last few weeks,
right,
Europe is more and more starting to come round to America's view that actually maybe there should be sanctions,
yep,
on Iran. But they still don't like this massive power that America has. They know that this power is going to be something that is hard to undermine. This vehicle that they've put together, it's to work on food and medicine. They're not even trying to get it working on oil yet. And so what they're doing is they're taking this opportunity to practice, to begin to assemble what they need to fight the United States economically. And if it doesn't work, but they learn some lessons, well, in this case, it's about Iran. That's not a huge deal.
Yeah.
But they're getting together, getting ready for the next fight that for Europe could well be a huge deal if it's about, say, Germany's gas connections with Russia.
Yeah, well, that's an excellent point. You can't help but view this move in light of, like you said, we were just talking about how Europe was coming around to the idea that Iran does need to be punished for its activities, and not just the nuclear activities, but the terrorism that it has spread in Europe. So there definitely has been a hardening of Europe's position against Iran. The fact that it's willing to take up this fight over this issue in the way that it is, and really, as you said, it's not really about Iran. That seems nakedly evident just looking at the circumstances that surround this.
Yeah, and it really is, like this article brings out in the title, it's a declaration of divorce between these two powers, that it's Europe saying, we're going to start trying to split our assets from the United States. We want to try and find a way of separating our economic system from America's economic system. And when Europe's economic system has been built on the same foundation as America's for 70 years, that's not necessarily an easy undertaking, but they're making a practical start on that process.
Well, you do have to view this in the context of what we've talked about, what we've witnessed over a number of decades that really do fulfill significant prophecies of America's economic decline. The fact that you have several nations in Europe, in Asia, that are taking deliberate steps to try to reshape the American-dominated global economy, to find alternatives to where they're positioning themselves to step into that breach in ways that will inevitably undermine America's economy.
Yes, we're seeing just a huge prophecy really come into focus right now with all of these different elements that you mentioned. You know, we've been talking about, and Herbert W. Armstrong is writing about for years, that America would come under economic attack, that these nations from around the world would work to undermine America economically. And this is based in even some of the most basic prophecies about the modern nations of Israel, Britain, and America in Deuteronomy 28 and Leviticus 26, that talks about these nations being besieged, that talk about them, you know, being then cut off from the world's economic system. And then there are more detailed prophecies that in Isaiah 23 that identify some of the powers involved: Europe, Japan, China. Mr. Flory was talking about that back in 2011. And since then, you know, what have you seen? You've seen Europe creating the world's largest trade zone with Japan. You see now some of these Pacific nations, and even including Australia and Canada, but a whole bunch of other Pacific nations getting ready to come on board with that. As is in the cover of our latest Trumpet print edition, Europe's now really going after Latin America and bolting them onto just this emerging, I mean, it's being done on a bilateral level or by group level, but you're seeing the assembling of this absolutely massive free trade zone that includes so many of these people that we've been talking about, and not the United States. So they're doing this on the one hand. Now you see more of these movements to separate themselves from America's financial system. How can we keep trading with people that America doesn't want us to trade with? How can we turn against the United States, build a financial system independent of the United States? And at the same time, China's working on that kind of thing. Russia's working on that kind of thing, looking at their own alternative to Visa and MasterCard, and just all of these different elements. And we're actually pretty far advanced now towards this prophecy of America being besieged, being cut off economically. So much of the ability to be able to do that is being built before our eyes right now. And you know, you can just really see this coming together.
Yeah, I think without that prophetic overview that we have, the individual pieces of this puzzle don't necessarily jump off the page as being terribly important in and of themselves, but you start connecting the dots, you start adding all of these pieces together, and you see a very consistent picture, and you could see how all of these put together, not only does it reveal the intent of these nations that are working against the United States interests, but the cumulative effect of all of these, at some point, there's going to be a tipping point where America's economy is not able to withstand the pressures that are being arrayed against it. I would encourage listeners to go and look at that article from Gerald Flory. The new Trumpet was just put up on the website this last week about America being besieged economically, talking about the Europe-Latin America relationship. It certainly does give you a sense of Europe's part and Europe's intent in the moves that it's making. It really does help to put moves like the one that Richard was just describing in prophetic context. We appreciate that, Richard. You are listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. Despite all the headlines about military cooperation between Russia and China, many analysts say these two nations don't represent a true alliance. One observer, though, says that they are dead wrong. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, that's right. There does seem to be an increasing number of Western observers who are concerned about the deepening intimacy that we see between Russia and China, these two nations that actively work against American and other Western interests. But despite the concern, for the most part, the consensus is that there's not a real military alliance between them. But this new analysis is very insightful and well-supported, and it says that consensus is wrong. This is by Stephen Blank. He's a senior fellow with the American Foreign Policy Council. And one part of his report here says, "The steadfast denials of a military alliance dynamic between Russia and China are not based on the evidence of arms sales, technology transfer, joint exercises, conventional and nuclear coordination, and long-term strategic dialogues." And then he goes on, another part of it says, "It is long since time that analysts and policymakers acknowledge the reality that is evolving right before their eyes." And he goes into some really interesting material about the labels that the Russians especially give to their partnership with China. You know, for years, the Russians called it a strategic cooperation.
That was the label they gave it. And then it was upgraded to a comprehensive strategic partnership. And then more recently, it was upgraded to a privileged strategic partnership. So
get out your thesaurus.
Right, exactly. And Stephen Blank says all of these terms are basically euphemisms to disguise what's really going on. And there is a Vladimir Putin statement from a year or so ago that it's almost comical because he's talking about how he has to keep on verbally upgrading the label that he uses for the Russia-China partnership. And he's talking about how it's difficult because the language doesn't seem to quite do it justice. But if you step back a little, you see that he's basically explaining how difficult it is to define an alliance without calling it an alliance and without acknowledging or admitting to the world that that's really what it is.
Well, I guess the question that comes to my mind is why change the language, unless they're trying to send a signal? Why would they shy away from the word alliance and yet still be trying to define just how much closer they're becoming rather than, say, just continuing to do what they're doing?
Yeah, it's a great question. You kind of get the feeling that they're, you know, sort of trying to play both sides. They want to scare the world with the idea of this Russia-China axis of authoritarians, but they also want to be able to perhaps deny it when it's convenient to.
So, but the facts on the ground are what we're seeing is very much an alliance, and it is very much exactly what the Bible says was going to happen between these two powers.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, it goes far beyond rhetoric, as he said there. If you look at the evidence of the arms sales, the you know, the landmark trade milestone that we talked about 3 weeks ago on the Trumpet Hour in 2018, they passed $100 billion in mutual trade for the first time. You know, in politics, they're in perfect lockstep almost all the time. But most importantly, it is the military cooperation in terms of Bible prophecy. That's by far the most important aspect of the alliance. Since 2003, Russia and China have had 30 major joint exercises, which is just a very high number for that sort of thing. And Stephen Blank actually called special attention to one of those joint exercises that happened in 2017. This was a joint air and missile defense exercise. And he called it a landmark that suggests a true military alliance because it required both of them to basically put all their cards on the table for each other and to put some of their most sensitive command, control, communications, computer, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance systems on full display for each other. Mm. So these kinds of systems are among a nation's most sensitive. So seeing Russia and China share it with each other during those drills really does indicate just a rare and very intimate camaraderie between them.
So what does Bible prophecy say about this?
Yes, well, Revelation, the book of Revelation, talks about an Asian confederation called the Kings of the East that will be formed in the end time. And if you put that passage together with other Bible prophecies, it's clear that this will be one of the main players in the most violent conflict that the world has ever suffered. And that's really why the trumpet carefully watches and warns about the strengthening ties between Russia and China. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has explained how Ezekiel 38 in particular proves that Russia and China will be at the helm of this confederation, Russia really in the leading role there. And he's shown that these two are already fulfilling the early phases of that prophesied alliance. One example of that came in 2014, after China declared support for Russia's unlawful annexation of Ukrainian territory. And Mr. Fleury said that support was, quote, a stunning fulfillment of a biblical prophecy. And then he wrote, we've been proclaiming for over 50 years that Russia and China would ally themselves in the end time. So notice there that he didn't say they would build a privileged strategic partnership or, you know, any of the other euphemisms that Putin uses. He said they would ally themselves. And then he continues and says, we are in that end time now. When these Asian nations, extremely powerful nuclear-armed countries, begin to show solidarity with each other regarding moves like that, what does that portend for the world? I tell you, it is woe to the world. It will cause many serious problems.
Well, I'm trying to remember when we first published the booklet, Russia and China in Prophecy. I think it must have been in the early 2000s. We've had that booklet surely for close to two decades. It might have even been late 1990s. But you see those two nations in a headline just because we've been pointing to those based on those prophecies, Russia and China, and you see this alliance just continuing to build step by step by step. It's, again, just remarkable to see how much biblical prophecy had had us all tuned into this from the very beginning. Jeremiah has written an article that should appear on thetrumpet.com very soon. It's called Russia and China, Have They Already Formed a Military Alliance? And you can also see that booklet, Russia and China in Prophecy, there on thetrumpet.com under our literature tab. And we'll put links to those in the show notes for the program today. Thanks very much for that, Jeremiah. Venezuela is in a political crisis, with an opposition leader declaring the president illegitimate and announcing himself as the new president, and other nations taking sides on which of the two presidents they recognize. Well, the Catholic Church has taken an interesting approach to this challenge. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, when you look at Venezuela right now, it is almost like a proxy war, where you've got the United States and Brazil and the European Union supporting the opposition candidate to the Maduro regime. And then you've got Russia and China and Syria and Turkey and Iran supporting the Maduro dictatorship. But what most people probably overlook is right now the most important player in Venezuela is the Roman Catholic Church. And as you just mentioned, they've taken a very interesting approach to this. When Pope Francis last week, he was in Panama for the Catholic World Youth Day, and he made some statements about how the Catholic Church isn't going to take sides. That would be pastoral imprudence, is the phrase he used. he's like, I suffer for what is happening in Venezuela right now, he said, and then called for a just and peaceful solution. And on the surface, it looks like the Catholic Church isn't doing what Francis said and not taking sides. They're actually kind of taking both sides. In that the Catholic Church sent an official Vatican representative to Maduro's inauguration to give the Maduro regime the Vatican's blessing. At the same time, the Venezuelan Bishops' Conference, that's the local conference of Roman Catholic bishops that administer the Catholic activities in Venezuela, came out and declared the Maduro regime illegitimate due to the rigged election. So now you've got the Vatican giving this this socialist dictatorship its blessing, and the local bishops' conference declaring it an illegitimate government. And it seems like there's some division between the two, but they've had some interesting research done by a Vatican watcher in Argentina, Elisabetta Pike, who actually found out that the local bishops' conference in Venezuela was consulted by the Vatican before they decided to send the representative to Maduro's swearing in. And the local bishops' conference also sought the Vatican's approval before declaring Maduro illegitimate, which means that the Vatican and the bishops' conference aren't at odds. They actually have had discussings about this and all agreed that this is what we're going to do. We're going to send an official Vatican representative to Maduro's inauguration. Meanwhile, the local bishops are going to declare him an illegitimate president. That does two things for the Vatican. It's kind of like a good cop, bad cop strategy. One is it's a classic realpolitik play of hedging your bets.
Not quite sure who's gonna win this.
No matter which horse wins this race, the Vatican can honestly claim that, oh, we supported that side.
Right.
Two, as I mentioned at the beginning, there's likely a plan here for the Vatican to come out on top by playing like the mediator or the resolver of this crisis. Current negotiations are obviously too secret to know, but 3 years ago, 2016, Stratford had some people on the ground that found out that the Vatican had talked with the Russians in an attempt to try to pressure Maduro to surrender control to the opposition and go into exile. Talked with the Cubans to accept Maduro's exile in Cuba, and then talked with the opposition party to try to promise the Cubans free oil, subsidized oil. So in which case the plan was Maduro goes into exile, a new pro-Catholic government takes power. Cuba accepts Maduro, continues to get oil from Venezuela at discount prices, and kind of everybody's got at least something they want.
So again, the Vatican playing all sides.
So yeah, you could definitely see in this Kurtzinger, because right now, like, Russia obviously wants its military bases and stuff that it's using in Venezuela, and the European Union wants a more government that's going to give them better trade deals and have a better economy than Maduro has, and the Catholic Church wants their bishops to have more influence. There's definitely ways the Vatican's undoubtedly working towards to make all those things happen. And kind of give Europe what it wants and the Catholic Church a position of prominence and Russia what it wants and China what it wants. Is like the only one who's not going to get anything out of the deal is the United States. Which brings us into, I believe we've talked actually, it seems like a lot on this program lately about the prophecies in Ezekiel 23, about this mart of nations. And we also talk a lot about this prophecies in Revelation 17 about these 10 nations in Europe that are going to come under the dominion of a church. We can put in the show notes an editorial by our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, entitled The Deadly Dangerous U.S.-Cuba Deal, which shows some of these similar realpolitik things the Vatican was playing at, talking with the Canadians and the Russians and the Cubans to try to get the Obama administration to open up trade with Cuba and the threat that poses to the United States. So that article will show what the Vatican's ultimate agenda to undermine America with deals like what they've already done in Cuba and what are doing in Venezuela. And then there's also Herbert W. Armstrong's classic book, Who or What is the Prophetic Beast, that will go through some of those scriptures I mentioned just in passing in Revelation 17 about the 10 nations in Europe ruled over by a church coming against the United States. And obviously Venezuela or Cuba are neither one or one of those 10 nations, but they also are under the same religious system that dominates those 10 nations. And so it only stands to reason that to one extent or another, they'd be integrated into that system.
All right. Very good. Thank you very much for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, more about the Pope and America having trouble finding a solution to the Syria conundrum, and also America being gripped by a freezing polar vortex. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Pope Francis is turning into quite the revolutionary, as evidenced by another major point he made in his World Youth Day message that we referenced earlier. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, so World Youth Day, it's typically one of the biggest events in the papal calendar, where in some cases in the past, millions have turned out to see the Pope speak and meet with the Pope and all these other stuff. this year it was just a few hundred thousand. The World Youth Day was in Panama, in Central America, partly because Panama is just a smaller country, partly probably because of still some of the fallout from all of those child abuse scandals. But during that speech, his whole message that he brought was basically one of social activism, was one where he was there exhorting the young people at this World Youth Day to go out there to make their voices heard and change the world. In a lot of ways, it was similar, almost some of the language, to a political rally where you're getting young people or you're getting people ready to go out to protest or to support a cause. A lot of what he talked about relates very directly to American politics, so he's been very condemnatory towards walls already. And I think a lot of people will be familiar with what he said about that. For example, in the past, he's called walls unchristian. This time he says that it's crazy that America's attempt and Donald Trump's wanting to build a wall across the Mexican border. He said that that is madness. It is fear that makes us crazy, he said. he visited a prison and he was meeting all the prisoners there. And he's so against walls that he basically said that even walls in prisons are wrong. He said that this attitude spoils everything because it erects an invisible wall that makes people think that if we marginalize, separate, and isolate others, all our problems will magically be solved. When a society or community allows this and does nothing more than complain and backbite, it enters a vicious circle of division, blame, and condemnation. So he spoke out against what he called the senseless and irresponsible condemnations of every immigrant as a society. That was in one of his sermons. In the same sermon, he exhorted people to be builders of bridges, by implication, instead of walls. He was very strong on climate change. Sounded a bit like he was going to go off into the rainforest and hug a tree at some points. He said, kind of in like this prayer bit, "Your son's ways of the cross continue in our plea of our mother earth, profoundly wounded by the pollution of her skies, the barrenness of her fields, the contamination of her waters, trampled underfoot by the disregard and a fury of consumption beyond all reason." So a lot of criticism directed against really positions that Donald Trump and America has taken in recent years.
Yeah, it just it seems like so much of what he's saying is very thinly veiled criticism specifically of the United States and even the current administration of the United States.
Absolutely. And some of it is because of the questions people are asking him, like the wall stuff that came up in a question. But at the same time, this comes up in his pre-prepared sermons. What he, you know, these are the talking points that he goes to this country saying, "I want to bring these out." So,
You wrote a blog on this that's up on the website, "Why the Pope Preaches Against America." And I love this quote that you included here from the American Spectator. "His sermons could have been written by Nancy Pelosi."
Yeah, exactly. And I think that Spectator article made a great point where it, because it wasn't just this kind of this negative message that he brought. He also brought a very positive message, an exhortative, stirring message. But it was the type of message that you hear from a politician. He said that God's vision for the world is not a promise far off in the future, having nothing to do with the present. And he said, he told young people, "God calls you in your communities and cities to go out and find your grandparents, your elders, to stand up and with them to speak out." And he told them they need to be part of a new world now being born, and that they need to go out and create a more humane world. You know, all of this very political rhetoric about going and actively right now creating a new world, and one different from this one championed by the United States. You look at what he said about capitalism in the past, different from that, one that is different from this society that doesn't let immigrants come in willy-nilly, different from that, and a different world to the one led by America, basically.
So as you bring out in this this article that you wrote, just the fact that this leader of the world's largest Christian organization is making these kinds of statements points you to the fact that the way the Bible talks about this church, it puts everything in the context of just how much political influence it wields in the end time.
It does. And you know, when we're talking about Europe, we often come back to Revelation 17 and this prophecy of a political power that's led by a church. Mm-hmm. And at the start of that chapter, it talks about a woman who commits fornication with all the kings of the earth. The woman in Bible prophecy is a symbol of a church, and she's involved in all the kings of the earth. And what I think is interesting about this speech is it's in Panama, it's in Latin America. He's a Latin American pope. He's been there continually. I didn't really bring it out in this article, but when I was talking about this on the Trumpet Daily yesterday, Mr. Ron Fraser has an article right from when Pope Francis became pope. And he said, based on these prophecies about what's going to happen to Europe, about these trade war prophecies that we've heard already about on this show, about the role the Catholic Church is going to take, he was saying, watch for this pope to really cement this relationship between Latin America and Europe. Mm. And to provide, we've talked about the trade relationship, but this provides a very important cultural underpinning. And so what do we see? We see the pope continually going to Latin America and condemning the United States, really bringing this region on board with this anti-American point of view that Europe is also a part of.
Well, we appreciate that. I would encourage people to go read Richard's article, Why the Pope Preaches Against America. He also points to that article by Gerald Flurry. It's called Why is the Pope Meddling in American Politics? And also in the show notes for the program, we'll put a link to that Ron Fraser article, which is called Restoring Europe's Latin Empire. Well, moving on, President Trump promised to pull the U.S. out of Syria, but America is still looking for ways to avoid the problems that will inevitably result when it pulls back. To this point, though, it isn't having great success, for this will go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, it seems like the United States is trying every way to get out of Syria without doing too much damage to the relationship they have with the Kurds. Just because that's been the Kurds have been the strongest ally of the United States in the fight against the Islamic State inside Syria. And the Kurds, they're mainly operating out of the northeastern parts of Syria. And the United States forces that are embedded with them are really guaranteeing their protection, not just from the Islamic State that they fight against, but also the Turkish regime, or Erdogan's forces that seek often to destroy the Kurds, as they've done for about 100 years. And so with the United States leaving, there were fears that Turkey was going to then take over the territory that was gained by the Kurds and actually start an open war against them. The U.S. is trying to stop this. Okay, so what has happened this week to try and counteract that and allow for the United States to still leave is that the U.S. is actively pursuing a European solution. European forces right now, that is mainly France. They're also reaching out to the UK and also Australia as well. These are nations that are already a part of the multinational force that is fighting against Islamic State in Syria. And they're saying to UK and France mainly right now that, hey, can you take over our specific mission in northeastern Syria? Can you embed your forces with the Kurds and set up a safe zone of 20 kilometers or 20 miles from the southern edge of the Turkish border from the Euphrates River over to Iraq? So that's kind of like the northeastern quadrant of Syria, which would be a safe zone where European forces would operate out of to ensure that if there is more fighting in Syria, the refugees have somewhere to go. It's somewhere to go that isn't governed by Turkey. Because that could end poorly for the refugees, since Turkey's built a massive wall and basically has fired upon refugees trying to come across their border of late. And so we don't have an affirmative yet from the French, but we have Secretary of State Mike Pompeo going to talk with them in Washington. There's going to be representatives from France and UK there next week to discuss this very plan. Joseph Dunford, he was in the UK in Europe last week to talk about this. And so this may look like something that goes forward.
We've been fairly critical of President Trump's decision to withdraw the 2,000 troops from Syria, just because it does seem like out of all of our foreign operations, America's foreign operations, this has been a fairly low risk operation with high rewards. So this doesn't seem like a good look for the United States to essentially say, we're pulling out, but we still feel like this is a really important mission. Europe, what would you say about taking this over?
Right. Well, this is part of what Mr. Trump is after. He's after other people protecting their own backyards. And he rightfully does see Europe being on the main receiving end of refugees, and that if they are going to be, if they want the refugees to stop, they should foot the bill. They should put their troops in harm's way, not U.S. forces. And so the United States, with this deal, is trying to bend over backwards to fulfill the promise of withdrawing troops, but not allow the whole situation to blow up in their faces, meaning its rise of Islamic State, death of the Kurds. And so the U.S. is not just saying, hey, replace us. They're saying, please replace us with your troops on the ground, but we will still supply you with a lot of different intelligence. We'll supply you with emergency evacuation if your forces become under attack. This, of course, was something that the Europeans are worried about, not just in Syria, but also Afghanistan, because they don't have the ability to evacuate their soldiers if there is a if they get injured seriously. The United States runs all those operations of these multinational forces. And so the U.S. is still basically saying, we'll take care of everything else apart from having troops right there in northeastern Syria. So that is, I mean, it's kind of a very, I would say, a nice option for Europe if they want to get more involved in Syria, to have the United States still in behind the scenes, still providing a lot of the financial support and the logistical support, but them being the face of the mission with troops on northeastern Syria protecting the Kurds. This is something that I think an eager France would jump at, a France that is eager to show itself on the world scene.
Well, it is interesting that that would be the deal on offer, considering the United States cited financial concerns as being one of the main reasons why we needed to pull out. But this is, the way that this is playing in the pages of the Wall Street Journal, it's talking more about the fact that the United States is trying to assemble this coalition, but no one is agreeing to the proposal just yet. I suppose we just have to wait and see the way that this plays out.
Yeah, well, if they're smart negotiators, Europe right now, they will wait because they know Mr. Trump is desperate to get out. He's revealed his endgame. He wants to get out. He wants to do it at all costs to get out. He's promised the troops are coming home, so now he's got to bring them out without, you know, making the situation deteriorate so much. So I think the Europeans, this is a great opportunity for them. Bible prophecy obviously speaks about, based on Psalm 83, that Europe is going to get more involved in the Syrian arena. And we've been looking for ways that they would do that. And they have been fighting with the Kurds, both in Syria and Iraq, for some time. And so this is a very natural way that Europe would get more involved in Syria, moving us towards the fulfillment of that prophecy in Psalm 83.
We will keep our eyes on that situation. We appreciate that very much. Brent, this is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Another move by China to tighten its grip on the South China Sea. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, China announced on Tuesday that it has opened a maritime rescue facility on Fiery Cross Reef there in the Spratly Island chain in the South China Sea. And the government emphasized the peaceful purposes of the new center. They said it'll better protect navigation and transport safety in the South China Sea. But that's really in line with what we've heard from China since the very beginning of their project to build and militarize these islands in the South China Sea. It was just a little over 5 years ago now that the Chinese first began this incredible land reclamation project. And they've fairly consistently insisted that it is for peaceful purposes and not for anything militaristic. But over and over again, satellite imagery and other Western intelligence reports are published that tell another story. The evidence consistently shows that these are, you know, increasingly being militarized and that they're intended to function mainly as air and naval bases, allowing China to just enforce its claims, not just to that Spratly Island chain, but to almost the entire South China Sea. So this new maritime rescue hub on Fiery Cross Reef might have some kind of peripheral, you know, civilian purposes, but right next to it, on the same very small island, there's an airbase complete with a 9,800 foot long runway, an early warning radar system, anti-aircraft weaponry, and even a missile defense system. So if you put this new facility in that context, it really does look like just the latest step in China's militarization of this territory that does not lawfully belong to China.
We've talked about it quite a lot, but can you just explain to listeners why the South China Sea is so critical for China?
Yes, it really is one of the most valuable areas of ocean on the globe, not just because of its immense natural resource wealth, which includes billions. It's 11 billion barrels of oil and about 190 trillion cubic feet of natural gas that are estimated to be there, but mostly because of the trade that passes through. It's more than $5 trillion worth of trade that flows through this area each year, which is more than 30% of the total global shipping trade. So it's just an exceptionally important region. And that's really why China is investing so much into these islands, just to be able to lock it down and control it. And Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has said that China's militarization of these islands, mostly because of that, you know, the importance of the trade route there. It should alarm the world because it means, quote, China is steering the world toward war. He wrote an article in July 2016 by that very title, China is steering the world toward war. And one part of the article says, quote, these militarized islands now function as forward bases for Beijing to challenge 7 decades of American naval dominance in the Pacific Rim. This should alarm the world, end quote. And he explains that this activity from China will soon play a part in the fulfillment of a Bible prophecy about modern-day America and Britain being besieged by China and other nations, which Richard spoke about earlier in the program. And Mr. Fleury says China's development of man-made islands in the South China Sea is one of many areas where onlookers today can already see this prophecy moving toward its fulfillment.
All right, well, we'll put a link to that article by Mr. Fleury, China is Steering the World Toward War, in the show notes. And also, Jeremiah has an article about this Beijing opening maritime hub to tighten the grip on the South China Sea. That'll be appearing on thetrumpet.com soon. Thank you for that, Jeremiah. Well, now that we've covered all the grand geopolitical puzzles of the world, we'll talk about the weather. It's been pretty nice here in Oklahoma lately, but not so in the areas where many of our listeners are. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, they're breaking records up in the Midwest. I think the last figure I saw is there were 16,000 people in the Chicago area out of power, in a very bad time to be out of power, because this polar vortex has temperatures have plummeted to 20 below zero across North Dakota to Northern Illinois. With some areas getting much colder than that, I think the record was set in Mount Carroll, Illinois, that hit 38 degrees below zero. For context, I think I saw it said that it's about 75 degrees colder outside your house than inside your refrigerator.
Whoa!
if you live in some of these areas. So definitely the coldest snap that we have on record for the Midwest. And we'll include in the show notes our book, Why Natural Disasters. That book is more about earthquakes and fires and other, more headline-catching natural disasters. But there's also a verse, as we've pointed in this program before, in the book of Job, talking about how by the breath of God, frost is given. And God says to the snow, be you on the earth, showing that even winter storms like this are under God's control. And when they get so bad to an extent that they're having people freeze to death, there's been at least 8 people freeze to death, and the temperature's going up and something like this, it's not really natural. This isn't God's part of his natural plan for what he wanted for humanity. And there are reasons why things like this happen that are described in detail in that book, Why Natural Disasters.
All right. We appreciate that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker. That's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com, and we'll provide links to all the articles, all the literature that we talked about on the program today. If you want to email us your thoughts on what you heard, you can send that to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Pleasure to be here.
Thanks for having me.
It's been a privilege.
Have a good weekend.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Ammianus Marcellinus. The language of truth is unadorned and always simple. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.